Hello and welcome to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis. And this is where we celebrate life's good, bad and banana skin moments. Today I'm joined by author Samuel Z. Jones. Now, he describes himself as a prolific fantasy author with over 15 novels to his name. He espouses a complex theory of world being and maintains fiction is an exercise in psychological portraiture of people who do not exist. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Joan. Happy to be here.
Now, first question, what does the Z in Samuel Z. Jones stand for?
Zachary. I'd like to say that it stands for an unusual and interesting middle name, but no, it's just plain old Zach.
Zach is quite unusual. I love the Samuel Z. Jones. I think that's fantastic. And given the genre you write in, I think that works so well. But your statement here, a prolific fantasy author, espouses a complex theory of well-being, a psychological portraiture of people who do not exist, in the manner of the great old A-level questions, English A-level, please explain.
Well, world building is a major aspect of fantasy writing, so you're conjuring, creating a new world. You've got to create everything. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, orcs and goblins fantasy, you make it up as you go along, most of the bits are already there. And actually, no, what is the gravity of your world? Most people don't even realise that gravity can be measured, that we have a measurement scale for this. It's quite simple. Earth's gravity is 1g. What's the gravity of your planet? How many suns are there? How many moons? For my dissertation recently, I did a quick exercise in world building just using three moons and what that would affect on the gravity. And of course, then characters can jump from one moon to the other. Down inverts when you go a certain way up. And these are the things, like baseline things that you'd think about in world building, even before you're thinking about, do they have trees?
So this is all common ground for science fiction writers.
For science fiction, you'd do this all the time. You'd look at multiple planets, so you'd have characters going, it's pretty obvious that an Earth-type planet has one gravity, a Jupiter-type planet has 20. But in a fantasy setting, you wouldn't change those settings once you'd done it, because you're set on that planet.
Yeah, I get you.
But you'd want to create something that's easy to explain to the reader, that's easy to get across. If the sky is green, you're going to have to keep mentioning that, even though the characters wouldn't notice, because to them it's normal.
Oh, well, you've kind of blown my mind, because I don't read in that genre. This is all new to me, but of course what you're saying makes perfect sense. You're reimagining, you're creating a whole new world, so you're playing a form of God, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah.
So everything's up for grabs, mm-hmm. And it sounds to me as if there's some kind of science involved in that you're making it as real as you possibly can, given that it's a fantasy. So you're making sure it could work on at some sort of feasible
scale.
It's got
to be consistent. A good example is Terry Pratchett's one. In the Discworld, there's no electricity.
Right.
There's magic instead. So lightning is magical discharge. All of the things that we would use with electricity, they can fuel with magic. But it's a physical change. Electricity simply does not exist. Also in the Discworld, the speed of light is about the speed of a bicycle.
I see.
So these are physical changes, tweaks to the reality that actually affects how the fantasy can happen. So you write these rules.
Can they get their magic cut off like we get our electricity cut off if we don't pay the bill?
Well, yeah, you could. How the magic flows would be determined by what the physical and metaphysical rules were that the author had set.
And does that come from like a fantasy national grid of magic? Actually, I love that idea. I think that's what we need. That's what the world needs, is a fantasy grid of magic that we can all tap into. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, and there have been fantasy worlds based on that idea, on the idea of using resonant crystals or various things to tap this presumed energy. It's all because I don't actually do that in my writing. I do it completely differently. But
so tell me what you do, Sam.
What I do is I try to create the internal world of the main protagonist as the external world. So in The Red Knight, which is my flagship book, the lead character, Sabra, mentally, internally, we don't really go into her. We see her externally, we listen to what she says, we see what she does. So she's known through action and deed. But actually her mental state, her emotional state, is the fantasy world that she rides through. So in the first book in the series, Red Knight,
is quite mundane. She's in the woods, there are outlaws, it's fairly medieval setting. By the second book, it's glorious knights, King Arthur, a lot more fantastical, magic swords come into play. By the third book, it's wild alien landscapes and fantastical beasts, and these are her mental state, her experience of reality, the level of her thought processes reflected through the physical reality of the story.
So you've gone beyond unicorns and created a whole new zoo, have you?
I don't like to use anything that's stock from another author's trunk,
oh,
as
no,
it were.
Absolutely, no.
So elves, I'm known for my elf hate online. I have.
What is it about elves? Why are you elfist? You're elfist.
I'm not elfist.
You
not
are.
Elfist.
What have they ever done to you, Sam?
Tolkien drew elves direct from Norse mythology and created something new. And so many people since then have simply taken what he did and copied it and done it again and again and again and again. And you can call me elfist if you want. I don't care. I've read enough stories about bloody long-eared hippies living in trees shooting at squirrels. It's we can do elves differently.
Okay, so presumably you have got not an equivalent of an elf, but you've got your version of something similar. So what have you got?
Well, you must have heard some of my talks at Corderham.
I have,
I did,
but
about
not everybody.
The primal.
So introduce the island and everyone to,
yes,
to your creations.
But the we've got this sort of the archetype of the primal man, the Hercules character, now translated into an entire race. The Darians are supermen. They're a third gender. They're a third race of men. They are all male outwardly, but they don't breed by any method that we understand. They're born by some strange, mysterious life cycle that only they know. The rumour in the story is that they hatch out of eggs. But they form, or when born, they take on the shape of the dominant predator in the area, which is man.
And so are they good, predominantly good?
They're people.
Oh, so they can go either way?
Yeah, they're oddly a sort of insect-like society in that they form hives and military structures and massive cities. They're very authoritarian, very controlling, quite strict mentality. But they're also very honest. They're also very brave. They have good qualities and bad. It's quite fun writing Darian characters. I don't think I've done it in the book that we've got here to look at later, Baron. I don't think there are any at all. But they are the elves of the world. But they're also the trolls of the world. At the same time, they're the long-lived, immortal, advanced species. But they're also very, very aggressive.
Do you think we've all got a bit of elf and troll in all of us?
Well, these are archetypes, so, yeah. These are archetypes. They're images of facets of human personality. And hell, some people, you look at them and you go, oh my God, you're a troll. You're a troll.
Yeah.
You see that. You see some people, the build, the shape, it's like, I realise on radio people can't see my face when
no.
I do that.
But hang on now, look, you've got to pardon my ignorance here. Trolls, did they exist back way back, or is this...
Trolls are, again, an old fantasy, an old mythology.
They're completely mythological,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, yeah. Sort of not, well, yes, Viking, but also Slavic. So from Russian and Eastern European mythology, bleeding into Norse and then into English. But yeah, trolls, the whole living under a bridge, turning to stone when the sunlight hits them, that.
And it's interesting, we've got this, you know, bang up to date, we've got this, you know, you've been trolled on the internet and trolls on the internet and the way they behave, and, you know, it's certainly not a good thing, is it?
No, but that's the, I think it's a lovely expression, actually. I think it's resonant. It's great to bring back that almost Chaucerian era of insult. It's wonderful. Back under your bridge, troll.
Well, yeah, because they are hiding, aren't they? They're hiding behind the internet, so that sense, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of these people don't realise that they're communicating with a real person. And I mean, it's a disinhibiting environment, they say, that what you just type online and send out, people are like, oh, I thought those were my thoughts and no one could hear me. And
exactly. But they're often so targeted, aren't they? And they're mm-hmm. so specific and they're so cruel. And they've just run away with no concept of the impact that's had on their victim.
And
all the very real impacts it can have in people's life.
That's what I mean.
It can affect
yeah.
people's jobs, it can affect people's social standing, their family. I mean, people have ended up in court for trolling
yeah.
and been very surprised. And then, of course, you get the troll course online going, no, no, it's not fair, no. Yeah, actually, the guy lost his job.
Or worse, lost his mind because
yeah.
of you. Yeah.
So, yeah, there have to be rules about how we behave. We're in a civil society
yes.
and we're developing a virtual society, and I think the rules are forming.
Well, I think that's the problem with the internet. It's this no rules, no policing, isn't it? I mean, there's slight, some sort of moving in now, but by and large, it's all up for grabs, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Yeah, although net neutrality, the idea of a free internet, it can be whatever you want it to be. If you don't like a particular part of it, go somewhere else. There's infinite space.
Oh, yeah.
It's an infinite frontier. You can create your own forums,
yes.
your own threads,
find
in your
a way,
own
that's it, I suppose that's sort of in some ways very similar to a fantasy world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And some people use it like that, I
yeah,
think, don't
yeah.
they? They have their life that they curate online, which is often very different to who they are were you to meet them in real life.
Yes.
And I think the difference between the two can cause a lot of problems, because I think while they're so busy trying to maintain the front that they've got online, and they know in actual reality that that's not how it is for them.
We do that in all aspects of our life, though, don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, or in lots of them.
But right? I think, you know, like celebrities perhaps have always done it, film stars back in the day, you know, and they would have had their, and they still do, have their PR people to do it, so they put the front forward. But now, you know, right from teenagers and, you know, they're starting to do it very early on, aren't they? Put this image up, this glossy
yeah.
image with their selfies and their beautiful hair and their makeup. And in fact, maybe, like I say, the reality might be a lot sadder than the truth.
Well,
so
younger people, they're reaching for an identity, aren't they? I remember my 20s, it wasn't that long ago, and you're looking for to settle on the person that you are or the person that you want to be. And I just got out of uni doing I went as a mature student, so I was 10 years older than most of the people on the course, and
I want to go back as an immature student.
Maybe I should have gone as an immature student and could have taken the mickey a lot more freely, I think. But I could see people putting on their face, their identity, sort of projecting the image of who they thought they wanted to be. And from the lofty heights of actually being a proper grown-up,
mm-hmm.
you realise, like, see straight through it. And it's
but like you say, it's kind of endemic in that age, isn't it? And we all remember that, gosh, that time. But yeah, so I think it is interesting that's an infinite world online and this fantasy world that you're creating. And what must it be like to be in the head of Samuel Z. Jones, where you've got all this amazing new stuff that you're creating from scratch and giving it to an audience? What's that like?
You've been at Boniface,
yeah.
Hill.
Yes.
Still on top of Boniface.
Yes, yeah, so that's almost a mountain. It's as close as we've got to a mountain.
Turned on the summit of a great hill and looked in the horizon. You can see everything in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Then imagine that you can conduct the weather. You stand on the hilltop and thunder will crash at the gesture of your hands. Dragons will rise from the sea. Great armies will do battle in the plains below purely because you happen to be watching. And you can zoom in and see exactly what's going on and exactly how and why. And then you just follow a character, follow the events, follow the people and watch as an observer.
Please tell me you go up there in a purple cloak and a pointy hat with an orb in your hand, Sam.
No, but I have a friend who does.
I love that vision. That's a fantastic way of describing it. I like that.
The other one is how the stories actually occur, how the characters occur, is I have a regular experience of mentally walking through the woods at night, and I see firelight through the trees, and I approach the camp, and it will be one of, by now, maybe up to a dozen people who live in this world who are camping out there, and I know them, and I've sat by their fire before, and I approach the camp and I say hello and sit down and chat with them and find out what they've been doing. And that's a lot of the stories are framed, at least mentally, from that perspective. For me, the question in writing of who is the narrator,
Yeah.
The narrator as a character, as a voice, as a personality, as a limited source of information. Well, who's the narrator? Well, it's me, but I'm telling you the story as it was told to me by someone in that world who knows. How they know, I don't know.
So even though you're setting these novels very much in a fantastical land, the characters and the characterisation, I'm assuming, is obviously got to be based in real life, isn't it?
You have to base upon what people are actually like. I don't draw on people I know, but I would look at a mannerism that someone had. I wouldn't say, oh, I need a barman in my story. How many barmen do I know? And you get to be the barman in my story. No, I wouldn't do it like that. That creates a very two-dimensional fictional character, and it doesn't do justice to the real person that you're trying to
But
simulate.
Surely you take elements from people.
Yeah, I would take mannerisms, yeah, of the barman. Certain expressions, certain ways of behaving, a description.
And what about the emotional side of their character?
Now, that is the weird thing, is trying... Once you have a character who's detailed enough, who's vivid enough, that they seem to write their own dialogue, and I'm sure you get the same thing, where the characters just spark.
Yes,
and
yes.
At that point, it becomes an exercise in trying to understand emotions that you haven't directly experienced. So I look a lot at trauma and the later consequences of negative actions, of violence. I mean, my stories are very violent. The Baron Maruna, I think, starts with a young woman getting her throat cut and proceeds to have three chapters of hand-to-hand combat. It's all perfectly necessary for the story, I assure you. But we're looking at the emotional impact of those events. It's not just violence for violence's sake. It's why are they fighting? Who? And what effect does it have upon them? What are the unforeseen changes? So our two characters in Baron, the obvious storyline would be for them to have some kind of affair. They don't. What they have is this shared experience of trauma that then changes them as people.
And that could happen in the normal world, couldn't it?
Yeah.
In our world. So
yeah.
What you're translating that into this fantasy world. It's so interesting to hear your side of it, because, like I say, it's not a genre I've ever read, let alone written in. And my stuff is so based on reality, and it's apps in people I know, people I know very well, and then reimagining how they'd react to certain situations. So taking it into fiction that way. But it's so, you know, informative to hear how you mix the two worlds to great effect. And having heard your work, it's very funny as well, and that's an aspect of your stuff that I really do enjoy.
That's come with confidence. Yeah. I've written a lot, and it's why I brought a later book for readings rather than an earlier book, because the comedy has started to come through. I'm more relaxed now. Fantasy is very straight laced as a rule. I don't think there's very much humour in Lord of the Rings. You know, Pratchett, again, famous for being funny, but most fantasy is very dry. People very rarely crack jokes, or
I think, and that was a great thing of hearing you for the first time, because I thought, oh, maybe this isn't going to be my thing, and then listening, I thought, oh, this is great. This is just my stuff, my humour, but set in a different time span, different world. So, I would love to hear some of that now, please, Sam, if you've got something.
Well, we've been talking about wit, I suppose, so I have a short...
Yeah, so on the theme of wit, wisdom and pratfalls, then brilliant place to start with the wit. Thank you. But I just find it brilliant. I mean, and you've written so much, haven't you? You've written 15...
20.
Oh, Sam, my goodness me. I mean, that's incredible. And it's not like you're an old man, that's his career. You have done this... How long does it take you to write one book?
Hard to say. I write three at a time.
Oh my! See, this is what I mean. You're working on all these different levels.
Yeah, but 5 years will go by without one being finished, and then suddenly three will be finished.
Well, that's okay. That's okay, because it takes me a year to write one. So
on
it's
average,
not
it's
similar.
A year.
Yeah,
on average,
similar.
It's a year, on average.
Different way.
Yeah.
Okay. So, have you got something?
I do.
Lovely.
Yes.
So, what are you going to read for us?
I'm going to read from The Baron Maruna. It's a very short piece, but it makes me laugh.
Take it away.
So our three knights have found their way to the Mystic Castle that they've been looking for, and they're wandering through this deserted ruin, wondering why they've been sent here. The light of the candle failed to pierce the darkness of the room, and Armitage had to lift his lantern high to drive back the shadows. The chamber had once been a shrine, but to what god none could have said now. The place had been incongruously redecorated, and it was here that the castle's inhabitants apparently dwelt. To one side of the room was a fireplace, stacked and unlit, like the one in the Great Hall. Beside it was drawn up a large, comfortable chair. There was much less dust in this room. The place was neatly kept, and the smell of mildew held at bay by a musty but not unpleasant aroma that the three knights could not at first place. "Roses," Armitage said. But Aelin shook his head. "No, smells like... a wee Drukit Duglight." Armitage and Lunid turned a joint look on Aelin. "A wee what?" Lunid asked. "Och, you ken what a dog is, eh? Woof woof, wag of the tail." "You mean a dog?" "Aye, a wee dog." "And Drukit?" "Well, I ken you'd say wet," Aelin conceded. "Drenched like." Lunid muttered something obscene. "So it smells like wet dog hair in here, yes?" "Aye. And roses," Lynette added. Odd combination.
Lovely, lovely. I like it. I like it very much. Thank you for that, Sam.
It's a short piece. It's a bit out of context, but that just a little interplay between the characters in the middle of, well, in the middle of the deserted, mysterious crypt. Who knows what danger?
Well, it just sounded very human to me, and. Like I said, we're in this different world of fantasy, but, yeah, nice.
Well, it's like any other writing. The characters have to have a distinct voice, distinct personality. It should be, probably apply the same standard, that you should be able to drop the speech tags and know most of the time who's speaking.
Who's speaking, absolutely.
Just because they speak differently.
Yes.
And there's a knack to that, isn't there?
Yes. Well, once you get inside their heads, then they take it away usually, don't they?
Mm.
OK, we're going to have a short break, and we'll be back with... more of Samuel Z. Jones' Wisdom and Pratfalls. See you after the break.
This is Vectis Radio.
The Castle in St. Helens offers 4-star self-catering accommodation in 2 properties sleeping up to 7 people. The properties have secluded grounds with off-road car parking just a few minutes' walk away from the beach and a village green. St. Helens is a charming village, and the castle is an excellent base for your Isle of Wight holiday, whether you want to explore all the island has to offer or just get away from it all. We're open all year, dogs are welcome, and short breaks are available. Go to our website at www.sthelenscastle.co.uk for full details of prices and availability, or call us on 01983 875 993, that's 875-993, to find out more or to book your ideal getaway.
Want to beat the NHS waiting times and be seen by an experienced physiotherapist? If you have an injury, ongoing pain, or just want some advice, contact Physiocare and Sports Injury Clinic today. We are the largest and oldest physiotherapy practice on the island, with 3 practices in Ryde, Bembridge and Cowes, and our aim is to see people within 48 hours. We're registered providers for all the major UK insurance companies. Let our enthusiastic team help you. Contact our friendly and knowledgeable practice manager Rachel on 01983 812 576 or by email manager@physio-care.com or on our website physio-care.com.
Physiocare are proud sponsors of the Award for Sport at the Isle of Wight Sports Awards 2016.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, welcome to the 4-Piece Project. 11 to 19-year-olds are welcome to the course. The course is 100% free, and it contains podcasting, learn it, upload it, say it, mean it, talk to it, presentation, know it, promote it, make it, create it. And that's just the surface of the project. Come along to the Riverside Centre in Newport and contact Macca at ian.mac@vectusradio.com.
All we hear is Radio Gaga.
Stay social and get in touch. Give us a call on 01983 240 666.
The Lunchtime Social, brought to you in association with White Fibre, providers of the fastest fibre optic broadband on the island. Call them on 01983 240 240. That's 01983 240 240.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my guest today, Samuel Z. Jones, who is a prolific fantasy author. And we've heard some of his wit, and well, we've heard lots of his wit. Now we'd like to hear some of his wisdom, please, Sam.
Okay.
Where do we start?
Where do we begin? I'm so wise and humble. It's just difficult,
indeed,
really. Just ply the vast seas of my mind for something suitably deep. No, I'm kidding. I have a piece here. One of the most popular passages from The Red Knight was the description of the knightly virtues. What are the seven values of knighthood? And we were choosing which rendition of these to actually give.
But sorry, can you just for people like me who are not in this headspace, knightly virtues, is this something you've come up with, or is it a fact in the knight world? If I were a maiden in the knight world, would I know this?
There would be various interpretations of it, but we're not talking about virtue, V-I-R-T-U-E, uh-huh, but virtu, V-I-R-T-U, which is the old English form of the word, which has a slightly different meaning.
And what is that?
Well, first off, it has a sort of almost a divine charismatic quality, that these are blessings, that these are superior qualities a person possesses. But also, what is a virtue is not necessarily what we would consider virtuous. So okay, we think of the Christian virtues or the virtues of charity, but virtue could be applied to any list of qualities that you deem to be good.
So give me one example.
Well, a criminal who is extremely good at lying, dishonesty would be a virtue.
I see.
A virtue, according to Machiavelli, a virtue is anything that actually helps you to prosper or survive. So it may not be virtuous, but it is a virtue to you.
I've got you. It's a plus point in your line of work or way of life. Got it.
It's not good. It's not virtuous to be violent, but a soldier, violence is a
needs
virtue.
Needs to be. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, so in context, virtue in context is
okay.
What we're looking
at. Go through these knightly virtues for me then.
Well, we have them here in the piece. This is why we picked this piece. They're actually recited and explained, which gives us something of the mentality of the knights in this world. At first, the three knights did not know what they were seeing. Only when they drew closer along the causeway did Armitage breathe, "It's a Cyan." The litter party laid down their burden and the three knights approached. What lay upon the litter was not the numinous warrior they had met last night. Sir Cyan was no less huge, requiring eight women to carry his armoured weight, but in the light of day his power had fled, leaving only a skeletal husk barely strong enough to stand. By night he was terrifying. Now the chill that Lunid and Aelin felt was only the innate superstitious fear of the dead. Sir Cyan uttered a sepulchral gasp. Lunid and Armitage came closer to hear the undead knight speak. "I have thought long on your quest. Would that there were some wiser knight to give you counsel, for in life I was only a fighting man. But what wisdom I have, I will offer. There must be three knights to undertake a quest. So the ancient laws command." So it was when Sabra first set out. She herself, her mentor Meridian Chan, and the spirit of the old Daishen. But seven is a number also sacred to the questing knights, and seven there must be when you reach the end. We three barons that you are charged to seek, and Lady Tethys herself, if ever we are to have victory. Hearken to me, while my strength lasts. Seven are the virtues of a questing knight. Valour, first and foremost, which is to fight no matter the odds, for none shall come against a knight in arms and withdraw unscathed. Justice, which is the wisdom of a knight to weigh all things unswayed by appearances or personal bias. Devotion, which is faith to your comrades and to your vows, never to betray them though they lead you to death. Ardour, which is the worship of the quest with the passion of a martyr, that a knight should follow unwavering until journey's end. Discipline, which to a knight is mastery at arms and the daily observance of our laws. Righteousness, which must always be the truth in your heart, permitting no shadow of cowardice or deceit. Last, there is fortitude, which is the strength of a knight in body and soul, honed by adherence to the other virtues and by faith in the quest. Where common sense and reason fail you, cleave to these precepts of knighthood as firmly as you hold your sword, that the strength of the Dai Shen will be with you in battle, and her wisdom guide you on the road.
Thank you very much. So, they're talking about valour, justice, discipline, righteousness, fortitude, this type of thing. But these are all qualities that we would look for in a man today, aren't they?
Well, yes, but we're also talking here about women as well. Mm-hmm. With their leader, their messianic knight figure, their paragon, is a woman, a female warrior, and it's her example that they're following. We'd have a female knight in the story, Lunid, and it's a lot about her. Got an interesting theme in this one, in that we have a very mortal, normal woman. She's not really cut out for knighthood in her own mind. She doesn't want responsibility. She doesn't want this high-vaunted thing. She's quite content as a soldier. This is her life. This is what she knows. That's what she is about. And she finds herself elevated to knighthood for courage.
So greatness is thrust upon her.
Yeah. Mm. And then she has to face this paragon that they have ahead of them, and this whole attitude of this otherworldly life that seems to have no... that seems to put no store by all the day-to-day things that she would consider good sense, and that follows a completely a mystical way of looking at things and getting things done and motivating themselves to action.
It sounds a bit like maybe being a housewife and then being thrust into the workplace. So you think, the way I did it at home worked really well. I ran my house, I looked after my children, and now it's all very different when I'm here and I'm not sure it's working for me. Hmm. Yeah. Well, so are these... again, pardon my ignorance, Sam, but are these things that are sort of written in stone in terms of ancient laws of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, or is this
no,
something new?
Because again, for the same reason, good question, that I wouldn't take an existing person and try to copy them. I wouldn't take existing history, change the names, and try and just retell the historical events.
Okay. Now, I just wondered if it was a constraint.
No, but the same would apply to abstract concepts like honour and virtue. Mm. If you're creating a new society, then they have a new concept of honour. It's like we look at the samurai. They had a different concept of honour to the West. When creating, I don't know, Klingons, we don't make them space samurai. They have their own code of honour, their own traditions, their own set of beliefs. They're not just a carbon copy of something that already exists.
This is very deep and quite complicated, isn't it?
It should be, yeah.
Yeah. And your brain must work on many different levels to create this other existence. Yeah.
On a good day.
Well, mine certainly doesn't. So it's really interesting to talk to somebody like you that can obviously hold all these thoughts and then bring them together. So how do you... Does it all go on up there, or do you write copious notes? Do you post it, you know, wallpaper the room with post-it notes?
No, it all stays on the laptop and in my head. Rarely do I do sketches or notes by hand. I see it playing out on the mind, and then I go in.
It's almost like a film.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Mm. But I can also go in to the character's point of view and hear what they've got to say, their feelings, their emotions, so you can tap in. And it goes back to what you're putting down on the page. It's people say I write good battle scenes. Well, most people would just think about the movement of the troops and the action on the actual action, the sound and the smell.
Mm.
The sounds and the smells, and you evoke these, and these are some of the strongest memory triggers. Everyone knows what mud smells like. So the smell of mud on the battlefield.
And blood, smelling like rust. And
yes, that strong rusty smell against...
I've just made myself sound like a serial killer there. I have no idea what blood smells like.
It's a strong rusty smell.
It is, yeah. So, do you dream in the fantasy world, or do your dreams mainly stay in reality? Well, actually, that's a stupid question, because most dreams are fantastical, aren't
no,
they?
But
are you dreaming about knights and valour and
weirdly,
trolls?
Weirdly, no. They don't take place in the same way. Dreams are very different. My dreams are mostly semi-lucid, but it's exploring... let's see, how do I put this very succinctly? It's, if I get on a train in a dream... It's always a train on the same train line. There are various stations, and I've had different dreams about doing the same train journey and getting off at different stations on the line.
But it's a normal train, you're not sitting opposite a troll or...
Could be. I had one dream where I took a train to a cemetery and picked up this little vampire moth girl who followed me home. That was I put her in a matchbox in the end and posted her. But that
and
was,
that was in your dream.
Yeah.
So does that little girl? Does Moth Girl exist in any of your work?
She was one of those images that I would love to work into the fantasy if I could figure where, because as I say, my dreams take place in the same neighbourhood, as it were, in the same in the same city. So I've seen the Moth Girl walking about the street in other dreams that she didn't actually play a part in, which that element comes into the story. I love crossover. I love one character's story as a main protagonist, then you pick up the rest of their story as a side character in another book.
I really like Moth Girl. I want to see Moth Girl in a book. So I want her to have escaped from her matchbox. I need to know how she's done that, having been posted. Where did you post her to?
Back to the cemetery. Where she was living.
Of course. Sorry. I've got to keep up. No, brilliant. You see, I had no idea about all this, so it's great. So please, don't let me be queen of the pratfall, which we both know I am. Tell me, Sam, that you personally have landed up with egg on your face. You have tried to make that big egg grand entrance and fallen flat.
Okay, I'll start with something that sounds like I'm boasting, and then you'll see where I'm going.
Okay.
A few years ago, I taught myself nunchucks. I mean, I taught myself to do this so well that I actually got...
For the uninitiated, can you just describe what nunchucks are?
Nunchucks is a rice flail. It's two handles of wood joined by a chain about 4 inches apart. We've all seen them juggled as a martial arts weapon.
It's a bit medieval looking, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They are about that period. But I taught myself to do this. I bought books, I bought videos, I spent an hour a day juggling these things. And at least one time, I was doing some flashy juggling routine and I wrapped the nunchucks around to try and change hands and smashed myself in the face. And I woke up lying on the grass with stars still going around my head, and that happened repeatedly, learning the chucks.
Did you get the little bluebirds as well?
Yeah.
Singing? Yeah, good.
Wasn't as bad as the time I hit myself in the balls, I'll tell you that. But yes, so I have had some very... My finest moments have occasionally been when the best pratfalls have occurred.
Yes, I think they make us, and they make fantastic stories, don't they? And like you say, they take that edge off. You know, you think, yeah, we're all human, and that's why I love them so much.
If you can't laugh at yourself, you've got no right to laugh at anyone else.
You know, I think guys sometimes, or women, think that they've got to be perfect and they've got to impress. Well, what always is for me... The endearing quality is when someone screws up in that way. You know, I think, great, you're human, you're just like me. Hurrah!
Have you seen a cat screw up a jump?
Sorry? Oh, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
They always stop and look around just to make sure that nobody saw.
Exactly.
And then they walk on like nothing happened.
Exactly, the falling off the sofa, edge of the sofa or the table when they're... Yeah, love it. But I can't do that. I can't do the falling off. You know, I don't do the walking off as if nothing has happened. I'm still there doing the kind of Dick Emery walk, you know, of shame. With everybody pointing and laughing.
Sometimes it's just better to laugh and
take a bow. So have you got a piece, a pratfall piece?
I do. It's not so much a straight up pratfall, I suppose. It's just the tribulations more, the difficulties that our heroes will have. I think it's funny anyway. Slightly longer than the other one. What, we have 2 pages?
Lovely. Go ahead, Sam. Entertain us.
They rode 3 days east through ever rougher terrain. With dawn of the fourth day, they worked to the first glimpse of the mountain pass leading to Newadathan. Between that sanctuary and the hill where Lunid and Aelin stood, the countryside swarmed with enemy troops. Noya's army had been invisible when they first set up around Newadathan. Months encamped had slowly revealed the army. A black stain on the earth at the mouth of the pass was the first sign. The turf churned to mud and stained black with blood. 100 yards from the mouth, the dark lines of entrenchments snaked through the trampled undergrowth. This was only the most outflung edge of the siege lines. The main part of Noy's army was encamped further east, beyond the south-reaching arm of the mountains. The pass was a narrow cleft in the rock, barely 10 yards wide, defended at its far end by the western gate of Newadathan. Lunid and Aelin sat in cover on the hillside, considering the view. They'd left their horses tethered well back in the trees and spent the first hour of the day contemplating the path ahead. "So," Lunid began, "we head down the road, ditch two of the horses, draw our swords, ride heroically at the enemy lines, charge their trenches, and kill everyone we meet. Dodging bullets all the way. Aye. Aelin nodded solemnly. It's a shite plan, Leonard, you have to admit. Yes. What would Sabra do? Leonard considered this. Well, I imagine she'd draw her sword, ride heroically at the enemy lines, charge their ranks, and kill everyone she met. Aye, all right. What would Sabart do? Well, oh, find some way to sneak in round the back, I suppose. Leonard lit a cigarette, glad she'd scrounged some tobacco along the way, and returned her attention to the landscape. Her calm snapped and she hit the ground at either side with her fists, the cigarette clenched between her teeth. But there's no way. There's obviously no way, because if there was, then the enemy would have found it themselves by now. Aye, but... Aelin settled a less frustrated eye on the landscape. Where Lunid saw only sheer cliffs barring the way home, Aelin saw the crags themselves as his native land, the threshold of Retreacy and the highlands of his birth. Do you not see that sheer side of green there? Sheer being the bloody word, Lunid muttered, studying the mountainous slope. Aye, but it's not, see? There's grass on it, so it cannot be quite sheer. Then you see there, where the rock begins, and you can first call it sheer. That wee crack in the rock as almost touches the grass. You're insane. It's like that. She held her hand and forearm almost vertical. Not to mention 300 foot if it's a yard. Even if we don't break our necks, we'll be seen and shot. Well, aye. But you see there, from the crack, that line of scree leading to yon dark line along the cliff there. Yes. That's the start of a landslide. The turf and the soil are pulling off the cliff, like the floor of the valley were getting deeper or the mountains pushing up, eh? Landslide, Leonid repeated, ascertaining herself of the most significant point. Aye, but not the now, Aelin protested. Do you not see us? We can high up the slope. There a ways north. Make our way along and follow the line of the slide up to the crack and the rock there. We'll be seen and shot. We can do it. We can get up there. Is there no a tarn behind New Adathan, aye? For the tarn, there's a way back in, a postern gate, eh? We'll be seen and shot. Leonid, Aelin spread his hands in exasperation. What would army say the now, huh? Leonid shut her eyes and smoked silently for a long time. Only when she had to open her eyes to roll another cigarette did she speak again. He would remind us that the legend tells of a secret valley in the mountains where Sabra rallied her army after the battle at Dor Adathan. There she ordered Captain Cure and the women's regiment to rally 500 rifles at Fort Giar and went herself to Castle Daishen. According to the story, Sabra reached the Winter Palace within a week of leaving the Hidden Valley. Aye, and how long since we passed the Winter Palace, eh? Less than a week. By which you mean to imply that that crack in the rock there marks the secret way to the valley spoken of in the legends, beyond which lies the hidden tarn behind New Adathan and the postern gate into the fortress. Aye, which the enemy have ne'er discovered in weeks of sitting and staring at the same view. You're right, it's a shit plan. We'll be seen and shot. Did I say that? Aye, three times you did. Leonid finished her cigarette and sighed, then stood up and dusted herself down before offering Aelin a hand up. It's better than my plan. Let's go.
Lovely. It was interesting to know that they smoked. I thought that was...
Well, yeah.
Yeah. That's...
There are also guns in this fantasy setting as well. The rifle women are the backbone of the military at this point. A lot of people don't realise just how early these things reached us as... Oh, hell, they smoke in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I say, I am new to fantasy, so...
It's a bit PC now, isn't it? Smoking's not popular now.
No.
But again, creating a culture, very similitude. Soldiers smoke. Yeah. A hell of a lot of them, they do. Yeah. It's be PC and not let them.
Mm.
No.
No. Well, it's your book. You can do it.
Not everyone smokes. Not everybody does.
So what age were you when you got involved in this new world of fantasy?
I was about 5. And a friend of my mother's gave us a copy of Steve Jackson's Shamutanti Hills, which is a solo adventure game book, and you work through it paragraph by paragraph, making the choices and rolling the dice to fight the monsters as you went through. And then we collected the four in the set, the sorcery set.
suppose, a bit like a
these
kind
were game
of,
books,
exactly,
yeah.
But a bit like the online gaming that people get so immersed in.
Well, yeah,
now,
it's the modern version of it. Yeah. Well, the bloke who published this particular book was Ian Livingstone. Back then, he was selling Dungeons and Dragons and these tabletop games. Mm. Now he's the man who owns Tomb Raider.
Okie dokie.
So he's moved. He's the head of Eidos.
Right.
So Eidos and a lot of these computer games actually came straight out of fantasy publishing.
Uh-huh.
Straight out of it. Yeah. Some of these games, the system that they use to keep track of damage and success and how well you're doing, some of them literally use Dungeons and Dragons. Just computerised. Does the numbers for you automatically.
Yeah. So you got immersed in this, and then how old when you actually started writing your own stuff?
11, 12. I got a short story shortlisted. I got into the shortlist of an adult competition when I was 11. And I can still occasionally see some of the themes and ideas, some of the characters re-emerge now, years later.
That's really nice, isn't it? Mm. So that growth, where it...
Well, Sabra, the Red Knight, mm-hmm. this towering warrior woman, she first appeared as Sabra, fully formed, probably just under 10 years ago now. And yet I remember as a child this figure of this Red Knight, this woman head and shoulders, you know, this woman taller than the average man in full armour. And I remember this character from my childhood imaginings. And others have come through in the same way. It's, you know, names and stories have gradually crystallised, but the initial images often run very deep.
And have you always stayed within the genre?
No, I've written historical. My first piece of work as a writer was a historical novel about George Washington. That was The Flame of Freedom, which I co-wrote with a chap called Gabriel Murray. We've just got back in touch recently. He's a very nice bloke. I've also written a superhero story, a superhero novel, just as a spoof, which... a bit of fun, really. I wanted a break from the swords and sorcery, so I thought I'd do capes and leotards instead. And that's... still, technically, that's fantasy. You're using the archetypes, you're using... But then you're setting it in a version of the modern world, a version of reality.
So would you ever consider just... Well, not just, but writing contemporary fiction...
I would love to write a novel about a desert island.
So is that your next project?
It's not my next project. It's like when I finished the fantasy saga, which is going to take a while yet. There's more to come.
How
when that's
many
finished,
more, Sam?
We've got 3 complete and unpublished ready to go, which will be released over the next 2 years. I'll just have to think about this for a second. About 5. In progress, and when I say in progress, I mean 50,000 words plus currently.
So my novels tend to, you know, I tend to finish about 70, 80. How many thousands of words do you get to?
Probably about twice that. 140,000 would be a good length for a fantasy novel in my mind.
You see, I'd make that into 2 books.
Well, I ended up with trilogies because I've written 250,000 word novels. Acherite Empire, that was meant to be a single novel, and it was literally a brick. So now that had to be rewritten and recut into 3 different volumes.
But your fans love this, don't they? And they read.
I'm reading
avidly.
Another one now.
Yeah.
Back from when we were talking before about my childhood, I was reading the Renshai series by Mickey Zucker Reichart, and I recently found these again in my collection. And I've been rereading them, and every single one of them is the size of a brick. They're 250,000 words long each. There's 6 of them. I'm through number 4 now. But I've had these for years. It's a lifelong obsession, and it's only recently...
Obsession, that's a difficult word, isn't it?
Obsession,
I mean, but you've used it, you've said it. So is that how you regard it?
I'm obsessed with the nature of reality, with our perception of reality. People have this... overpowering urge to believe in magic and the supernatural. Why do we have that? We believe in the power of the mind to affect the physical world. Why do we believe that? And in what ways is it true? In what ways do our thought processes affect our actions, affect the people around us? How do our perceptions actually change reality? That's a whole aspect of fantasy writing that I like.
And this element of escaping from the real world, isn't it?
Yes, but also of returning to make sense of it. Joseph Campbell talked of the writer as venturing into the other world and coming back with the treasure, the secret treasures of the subconscious, that this is what the writer does, the writer as shaman, as psychopompous, as a a guide into the liminal world on the edges of our perceptions.
Yeah, the, so psychopompous, is that another word for vain? Or?
No, psychopompous means the ferryman of the River Styx is
a
psychopompous.
See.
Odin is a psychopompous, one who guides between this world and the other world, taking us into that inner world, that which we all experience, which we all dream in, but most people don't explore. People get lost in it. When someone's gone crazy, they've gotten lost in that inner world. That's essentially what's happened to them. But the writer walks in and out of that world freely and brings objects out of it to show to other people. Say, look, it's not all scary in there. Look, we found this thing, we polish it up. Look at that gold there. Look at that gold. Yeah. I'm going to put it in a book. And weirdly, talking of the mind affecting reality, you put all this effort into writing a book, into crafting a story, and then you put it out there, and people pay you money. You've gone into the other world, come back with a story, and you have literally found gold.
That's a really nice way of looking at it, isn't it?
That's what it's about. That's the fascination. That's the obsession. How do you push on the invisible barrier between the two worlds and get something to push back?
Mm.
And we all work in and out of that world. The internet works like that. It's just a question of perception.
And your reader's reaction, you know, it's very gratifying when somebody says, I love your book, and you get a nice review. So as well as a kind of monetary reward, you get that feel-good factor that, you know, that year you spent sort of hiding away writing wasn't in vain.
It's
you
the recognition.
Touched
you know,
somebody and
you
they
know
got
this
it.
Yourself, the respect and recognition you get from people.
Yeah.
What we started from, in fact, wanting to be seen for yourself, or rather than having to project an image, you get seen.
Well, Sam, you've converted me. Because it's all about understanding things, isn't it? I just used to think, fantasy, no, not for me, don't get it. But listening to your work and listening to you explain the themes, I'm getting there. And, yeah, I am converted. And maybe some of our listeners are too. I'd like to think so. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Jane.
And next week, and thank you so much for listening. Next week, I'm back with Verity Bird, Islander Verity Bird, and she's going to be bringing her ukulele. So if you fancy a sing-along and bringing a bit of sunshine into your life, Verity's the lady. So look forward to talking to Verity and speaking to you again soon. Take care. Have a lovely weekend. Bye-bye now.